This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and history buffs featuring the minds and talents of the University of Texas at Austin. 15 Minute History is a partnership of Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin.
Hi, I'm Joan Neuberger, editor of Not Even Past and your host for this episode of 15 Minute History. Today, our guest is Frank Gritti. He's a professor in the history department at UT Austin, and he specializes in African-American history. And today our subject is the Harlem Renaissance. And he's speaking to us today from Paris via Skype. So we're really excited to have him here, but we may have a few momentary problems with the audio. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Joan.
So, Frank, why don't we start off with a general definition explanation? What is the Harlem Renaissance?
The Harlem Renaissance, it was a cultural, political movement which established, I think successfully, the importance and maybe even the centrality of African-American and African-derived culture and history to the evolution of the United States, to the evolution of Western civilization. In retrospect, I think, again, successfully, it challenged and overturned the prevailing notion that Black people, people of African descent, had no history, had no culture, and much of those assumptions consolidated, not just after slavery, well, during slavery and after, and in the 1910s and 20s, and into the 1930s, what we see is this kind of broad-based movement that, you know, across genres of art and music and letters, that basically sought to demonstrate the importance of Black culture and its contributions to the West.
Great. So you're talking about a movement that's cultural and political. It's probably hard to separate the two, but let's start with the cultural movement. Who are the most important figures at the beginning of the movement who really kicked things off?
Yeah, on the cultural front, I think what many of our scholars focus on are the writers and the poets, right? So novelists like Jean Toomer, who wrote Cain, very important novel, early, this is now 1923 or so. And also, you know, for me, Langston Hughes is extremely important in the early, as an early figure in terms of poetry, in terms of taking Black vernacular culture and speech and turning it into poetry. And Counting Cullen, Claude McKay, Jesse Fawcett, a lot of us focus on the writers and the poets. And indeed, you know, Harlem Renaissance is kind of a standard course in many American English courses now, like at UT. And then, I mean, then you're moving into the realm beyond that of musicians, Duke Ellington, Fletcher Henderson. And as important, I think, are not just the artists themselves, the writers, but also those who promote them. People like Alain Locke, who is a Harvard-educated PhD philosopher who takes it upon himself to sort of promote many of this younger generation of Black writers and artists. Charles Johnson, sociologist, who edited Opportunity, which is the periodical of the National Urban League. He's an extremely important figure. So you've got, you know, the artists themselves, but as important, I think, are these promotional figures, these figures who help promote the work of these, you know, mostly younger generation artists for a Black audience, but also across racial audience, across, you know, white audiences in the United States, but also internationally as well.
How would you explain how this whole new generation of artists and writers and thinkers suddenly emerged right at the turn of the century?
I would explain it by talking about a broader context of the period, namely the consolidation of Jim Crow segregation in the South, which is a major push factor in pushing African Americans to northern cities. There's a generation of college-educated people of African descent in historically Black institutions, Howard University, Fisk, Tuskegee, among others, and that's producing a kind of a new class of aspiring Black young people, some of them aspiring artists and writers as well. And then there's a massive, as I said earlier, massive migration of African Americans to the North, and also Black Caribbeans from the Anglophone Caribbean and also the Spanish-speaking Caribbean to northern cities, New York in particular, Harlem, but others. And so I think, you know, this combination of migration, political repression, and then also political aspirations heightened by World War One, the sort of need to bring the notion of democracy home, to apply it to black people. I think those are the factors that produced this tumultuous yet creative movement.
Mm-hmm. And you've written about Afro-Cubans in New York and in the United States and in the Harlem Renaissance. Maybe you could talk about the sort of international impact and influence on the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah, I think the international influence is great. And I think we know about it in Europe, in France, in Paris. We know about the contributions of English-speaking Caribbean people to the movement as intellectuals, as artists, as political activists. But the Spanish-speaking black diasporic element has been understudied. And I think for me, the Cuban aspect becomes very interesting, not because you have a massive millions of Cubans of African descent migrating to the north, but because Cuban artists and intellectuals are sort of brought, and writers and musicians are brought into this sort of broader circuit of performers that comprise sort of the Harlem Renaissance, right? These artistic networks mm-hmm. cultivated by black institutions in the North, and they're publicizing the work of Afro-Cuban writers like Nicolás Guillén, the artwork of sculptors like Teodoro Ramos Blanco. And so Cuba is interesting in the sense that the black Cuban writers and artists are also part of this movement, being sort of showcased in some of the more prominent Harlem Renaissance periodicals.
Okay, so there's this whole international dimension to the Harlem Renaissance that certainly I didn't appreciate before. Are there also sites of similar movements outside of New York, outside of Harlem, within the United States?
For sure, yes. I mean, I think, and this has been made very clear by a recent book called Escape from New York, a large anthology edited by historians Mika Mankalani and Devarian Baldwin, and they have highlighted precisely the notion of this new Negro movement that is very much part of the Harlem Renaissance is really happening throughout the United States. Chicago is a major site of black cultural affirmation, economic activity. The South Side of Chicago, what becomes known as Bronzeville, is a major site for much of the same thing we associate going on with Harlem. Economic activity, artists, intellectuals, and musicians moving through that circuit. Los Angeles is another site in the 1920s. And so I think the more we study about the Harlem Renaissance, the more we realize it has a broader national not as an impact from Harlem, but literally it's happening simultaneously, this cultural movement. New York is the sort of major site of it.
Okay, well, we've been focusing on cultural issues, but really the political is coming in now, too. So could you sort of summarize what the political movement of the Harlem Renaissance was, and then we'll talk about some of the details.
Politics is varied and diverse as the cultural movement is, right? Mm-hmm. One of the more well-known political movements of the Harlem Renaissance era was a movement called Garveyism, led by Marcus Garvey, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Marcus Garvey was a Jamaican immigrant to the United States. He settles in New York, and he gets involved in sort of Harlem, New York politics, but he basically helps lead what most historians call the sort of largest black mass movement in the history of the African diaspora, because it's really happening in Harlem, but also throughout the African diaspora, Cuba, Central America, various divisions throughout the United States. And Garveyism is all about sort of crafting a new politics of a new Negro, and that African diaspora should have their own nation, should have their own commercial enterprises, should have their own schools, very much a race-first philosophy that is very attractive to black people across class locations. I mean, that's one of the things about Garveyism, is a very much a mass movement. Then you have more elite middle-class movements led by the NAACP, led by, of course, the very famous black intellectual W.E.B. Du Bois, who eloquently articulated the aspirations for racial, political, civic, and social equality in the years starting in 1909, but really taking 1920 Harlem Renaissance era. And so you've got this kind of more middle-class elite movement galvanizing around the NAACP, and then you've got this mass movement led by the Garvey, Marcus Garvey, and then you've got a host of other socialist and communist movements that are also agitated at the same time, and often articulating similar sort of aspirations, but also very much in conflict as well around class and around the sort of ultimate goals of these movements.
Were socialism and communism popular among the members of the Harlem Renaissance?
I would say yes. I think a number of them are moving in and out of different socialistic, communistic organizations. Some of them are starting their own. So Cyril Briggs, born in Nice, sort of Western immigrant, called the African Blood Brotherhood, which is sort of advocating for black radical politics. A lot of these movements are led by West Indian migrants to the U.S., but also African Americans. A. Philip Randolph is very much in part of this embryonic labor socialistic movement. He's a very famous civil rights labor activist for many, many decades in the 20th century. And so, yes, you've got a host of sort of radical movements articulating all of this stuff. This also makes up part of the literature of the movement. They're producing their periodicals, they're producing essays, they're producing all sorts of political tracts, and that very much comprises the archive of what we call the Harlem Renaissance today. Mm-hmm.
So they're all in dialogue with each other about how best to promote African Americans and African American culture and lead towards more equality.
They absolutely are in dialogue with each other and often in conflict with each other. And I think, I think many of the movements were jealous of the mass appeal of Garveyism. And in fact, that led a number of sort of black or African-American, black Caribbean activists to advocate for the overthrow or the end of Garveyism. They sort of are very happy that Garvey meets his demise in the mid-late 1920s. Mm-hmm. So they're in dialogue with each other, no question about it. And sometimes it erupted in open conflict.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense that there have to be different ideas about how to move forward. What other kinds of tensions are there within the Harlem Renaissance?
Yeah, I think the political tensions I just described are very much reflective in the promotion and the reception of Harlem Renaissance writers and artists, right? I think, like all artistic movements, they can't be neatly packaged into something that has one message. Mm-hmm. And I think a number of including W.B. Du Bois and some of the sort of more elite leaders were a little anxious about the sort of ways in which writers like Langston Hughes were portraying black life, right? I mean, Hughes is writing poems in the speech of what he imagined the black vernacular speech. He's talking about things that are happening in the nightclubs. He's talking about, there's a poem of Beale Street, Love, in which he's talking about black domestic violence, right? So he's talking about things that are sort of seen as the ugly side of black urban life and rural life in some cases, and some of the African American elites were very anxious and upset about that. I mean, like 1927, Langston Hughes's Fine Clothes to the Jew, the volume of poems, is very much negatively received by a number of prominent black newspapers. And so you've got this class tension, around sort of the politics of respectability and the need to, on the one hand, project that African Americans and black people have art and culture. On the other hand, they want to do it in this sort of sanitized way that many of these artists are not interested in presenting.
Mm-hmm. So far, we've been talking almost entirely about men. Mm-hmm. But there were some important women writers and activists, weren't there?
Absolutely. So, I mean, among the novelists, Jessie Fawcett and scholars, including our own Jennifer Wilkes at UT Austin, have talked about the works of Fawcett and a number of other African-American writers. Then there's among the black radical activists, Grace Campbell, was very much part of sort of those black radical movements galvanized by a lot of those Caribbean intellectuals and activists. You've got Eric McDuffie's new book on black radical women in the communist movement, Louise Thompson. You've got Zora Neale Hurston, writer, anthropologist, researcher, black folk life. So absolutely. I mean, I think what much of the more recent scholarship of the last decade or two has really focused on not just the contribution of women, but also the ways in which sexuality is very much part of queer sexuality is a part of the life of these intellectuals, but also in the themes of the works themselves. And so we have a much more enriched understanding of this movement that's beyond a kind of male-centric narrative that had predominated beforehand.
Mm-hmm. And Harlem was very attractive to white intellectuals during this period as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. White intellectuals, Carl Van Vechten, is extremely important in the Harlem Renaissance, right? I mean, he's the one who's putting a lot of these aspiring black writers and artists in touch with some of the main presses at the time. Knopf, for example, was publishing a number of the works of Hughes and other writers associated with the movement. Carl Van Vechten is sort of shepherding their work to them. He becomes a documentarian himself by photographing a number of these artists and writers. Then there's the patrons, right? Osgood Mason, who bankrolled a number of these artists and writers and had these kind of complicated relationships with Hughes, with Hurston, with Alain Locke. And then, of course, there's the folks who are packing the Cotton Club and coming up to Harlem and seeing the jazz and the dancers at the Savoy and the Cotton Club and other clubs in Harlem. And so there's no question that it's a cross-racial phenomenon that, on the one hand, is emblematic of a genuine interest in black culture and black art and black writing, but also is invested in a kind of primitivist view of black life, right? So the idea is that they're going there and consuming these culture products because they're perceived as exotic and different and therefore exciting in that way.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of whites are going up just to consume exotic black culture in the clubs in Harlem and are also consuming a lot of the writing and political and cultural writing. Do you think that there were any positive impact of this new sort of interaction between blacks and whites?
Absolutely, yes. I think that notwithstanding the fact that these interactions are driven by this kind of exotic, or the desire for the exotic, the desire to sort of pander to white audiences and to consume that kind of exotic culture, there's no question that the movement has a tremendous impact in increasing the awareness of non-blacks to this vitality of black culture and its centrality to American and Western life. And I think the Van Vechtens and all the publishing houses that publish these writers, the nameless people who we don't know who went to these clubs certainly gained a greater awareness of the artistic genius of a Duke Ellington, mm-hmm. a Fletcher, Henderson, a Langston Hughes, no question.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think was the impact of the Harlem Renaissance on American culture in the long term?
Yeah, in the long term, I think that it's a tremendously pivotal moment in the evolution of African Americans, people of African descent in the world and in the United States. And I think that the Oscars of a couple of days ago sort of reinforces that point, right? I think that the critical acclaim that 12 Years a Slave has received, and even Django Unchained last year, those are just two small sort of cinematic examples that demonstrate that, notwithstanding the fact that they're about complicated themes like slavery and oppression, there's no question that non-blacks and people throughout the world understand the vitality and the importance of black cultures to American and Western life. And that's precisely what the New Negro Movement was trying to show. And so I think that, again, a lot of those tensions I described are still there. But nonetheless, I think you have to conclude that even with its limitations, the movement, and obviously this is also because there's been other cultural movements after the 1920s, like the Black Arts Movement, the 1960s and 70s, right, among others. I mean, hip-hop culture, it's a tremendous impact among young people over the last 30, 40 years is just one example I think you directly link that to the legacy of the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could talk about this for hours, but we're going to have to stop. So thank you very much, Frank.
Thank you.
You can find a transcript of this episode, along with supplemental documents, suggestions for further reading, and correlations to this Texas and National Educational Standards for History and Geography on our website, blogs.utexas.edu/15-minute-history. That's the numerals 15-minute-history. You can also find a link to suggest topics for upcoming episodes. The University of Texas at Austin is a free speech campus. Opinions and viewpoints expressed in episodes of 15-Minute History do not represent the official position of the University of Texas or of any of its colleges or departments. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.